Okay. I don't see any beginners here. I thought that we're gonna need to do some proofs. Yaakov, you told me there's a lot of new people, huh? Yeah, I don't see anybody new here.
I'm new.
Is anyone new here?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yesterday they have a different Yitzhak. There's a new Yitzhak.
No, I tell you why. Because if we don't have anybody new, we might as well just go right into the questions and answers.
Yeah.
I don't need to show the proofs again and again and again.
Right.
Yeah.
Most of the people saw the
we saw the lecture last night.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, the original plan was questions and answers.
On the previous session.
Yeah, right. Then he called me up. He said, there's going to be new people coming. Maybe you do half and half. Half proofs, half questions and answers.
Just let's see the proofs.
A drop. Okay. We'll show one or two proofs. But in general, then I want to go right away to the questions and answers. So,
same.
Yeah. Okay, when we're speaking about proofs, no. Leave the lights on. When we're speaking about proofs, is it possible to prove that the Torah is the Word of God 100%? Or are we always going to have to live with some kind of doubts that it's divine? Yes, no, the rabbis wrote it, it's a history book. It's words of wisdom by many different people. There's all kinds of opinions. There are many ignorant people happen to think that to be religious means just to have faith. Some people may say that spirituality, it's all based on emunah, on faith, believing. It's nothing to do with knowledge. It's nothing to do with knowing. It's only believing, which is a critical mistake. Why? In science, believing means not knowing. When you say, I believe in God 70%, or I believe that the Torah is the Word of God 70%, it actually means that you also have a doubt 30%. You're not sure. When a scientist say, we believe that if we're going to mix those two ingredients, something will happen, and he say, I believe, then the next question will be, what's the percentage of your belief? And he's going to say 50%. Right away you understand that 50% he does not believe. Based on that, to change your lifestyle and to dedicate and to devote your life to a book of instructions, and with a 50% or 30% chance that in the end you will find out that it was all a waste of time, it's too shaky. It's very, very risky thing to do. Is it possible to think that God would give a book to people and he will do everything he can for the people not to be sure about his book, if it's the word of God or not? Does it make sense? If we see through the entire Torah, we see hundreds of times that God not only is requesting, literally is begging the Jews to follow his Torah. In some places, it's really embarrassing to see the language is really a language of someone who really begs. May they will listen to me, that I should reward them, and all kinds of examples like this. When we read in the Torah that the request of the Creator of the world that his children will be faithful to him and pass this test, that he should reward them in the end, and then in the end he's going to give them a book which has so many doubts or questions, it's not so realistic. If any, it makes a lot of sense that the Creator of the world will be very interested to publish his book in front of many, many witnesses. Today we have more than 80,000 religions and cults. More than 80,000. Judaism is the first religion that started, and right after that, many, many religions and cults started trying to copy the nation that received the book directly from God. We have many, many differences between our religion to all the religions that came after. One of the main differences is that we are the only religion that was received in front of 15 million witnesses. Every religion that started after us, with no exception, started always with a story of one person without not even one witness. Nobody was able ever to bring one witness to his story. It's right away start with 50% doubt. Someone came and said that he had a dream, or someone came and said that the angel gave him a book in the desert, or someone said that he saw the light. Yes or no? 50-50 right away. The only nation that stood in front of the mountain and heard the voice of God for the first and last time in history is the Jewish nation. Right after, we went through a process of 40 years in the desert until we went into the land, as the Torah already promised, against all odds, that we're going to occupy the land, even though there are 7 great empires sitting there with strong army. And we had no army whatsoever, because we not exactly are expert in wars at the time of the Torah. You know, it's all children and babies that came out of Egypt. But the Torah, God promised us that He's going to send all the nations out and will prepare the land for us. And you know, for those who want to claim that the Torah is a man-made book, obviously you cannot ignore the fact that no man will take such an unbelievable risk. What man would promise that this small nation is going to occupy the land, that there are 7 huge armies waiting for them over there? It's against all odds. And history shows that the book was right, and many, many other prophecies. We are the only religion that have hundreds of prophecies. Those who the time for them came out already in history, they all were fulfilled 100% according to the details. Some of the prophecies are yet to come. The time for them did not arrive yet. But those prophecies that the Torah predicted all happened exactly as the Torah promised. No other religion whatsoever gave any prophecies in details. You know, some people wanted to say, for instance, there was a prophet named Nostradamus, that he predicted certain things. If he really knows a little bit about it, I was forced to learn it because people were bringing it up in the lectures. So I had to waste hours of my life for this nonsense, but what can I do? I had to do it. And I found 2 things. Based on 2 things that he said thousands of things. 2 of them looked a little bit like a prophecy. What did he say? There will be a king named Hitler, and they say, well, Hitler is the same almost. So they decided that that's a prophecy. And then he says something even better, that there will be a king, his name will be Michael, and he is going to have a birthmark, a stain, I don't know how exactly to translate it. And then, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev from Russia had like a birthmark on his forehead. So then that they decided that that's 2 prophecies. The prophecies of the Torah is completely different than this kind of prophecies, because it goes into many, many details. It's step after step. For instance, I'll give you an example of a prophecy. The Torah says that I'm going to give you the land, I'm going to send all the nations out of there, you win, you're going to occupy the land, you're going to build the holy temple, if you're not going to follow my orders, I will destroy the temple, and once the temple will be destroyed, there will be a nation that you don't recognize their language, that will come like an eagle, and destroy the temple, and send you to Egypt in boats. And over there, you'll become slaves, and the price of a slave will be like the price of 1 meal of a horse, which is $5 in today's days. That's about 7 prophecies in half a page, right there. Against all odds, and I'll explain what I mean. First, to occupy the land, naturally it's impossible against all these armies. Shh, please. Too many problems here. Second, we occupy the land. To build the temple, it's a second prophecy. It was built. It will be destroyed by a nation that comes like an eagle. What was the sign, the symbol of the Romans? Eagle. And it's also, the Torah says, this is a nation that you will not recognize their language. A nation that is very cruel, have no mercy on older people and children and babies, like the Romans were, if you know a little bit history. So all it needed that the one of the nations that is around Israel will occupy the land and destroy the temple, a nation that we recognize their language, right there it will be against the prophecy, because the prophecy say a nation from far come like an eagle. The signs of the Romans were eagle, the Roman Empire. We didn't recognize their language because they're not our neighbors. They destroyed the temple as the Torah predicted. They sold us to Egypt and they took us to Egypt in boats. What's the logic here? To go from Israel to Egypt, it's 2-3 days walking. Even if you rest a lot and you sit and you just walk a few hours a day, maximum it should take it's 11 days of walking. Why they would invest to bring so many big boats, taking hundreds of thousands of people to sell them to Egypt to slavery when they can just make them walk? Just make them walk, put some soldiers on the sides, and let them walk to Egypt. So the Torah said they'll sell you to Egypt, and they ship you there with ships, big ships and boats. It happened. Also, the price of a slave was like straw, like they feed the horses, a few dollars. And that's exactly happened. So this is just an example of one prophecy, which is actually a combination of 7 in one page. There's hundreds of prophecies like this. But the other indication is that when we read in the Old Testament that all the main religions that came after, such as Islam, Christianity, and others, they never denied that we received the Torah in front of millions of witnesses. They adopted the story of Mount Sinai. They called our Torah the Old Testament. Or the Muslims also call themselves Musa, which is Moshe, Moses, or Ibrahim, which is Abraham. All these names come from our Torah. And they admit that the Jews had the word of God in their hand until now. They just want to claim that they got another part, which we denied completely. But one very interesting thing here. In the Torah, when God comes to Moshe, and he tells them, go to Egypt and prepare to save my nation after 210 years of slavery. Now it's the time to release them and bring them into my land and give them the Torah. He refused to go. For 1 week, there was an argument. He kept making up excuses. My brother is 3 years older. I'm stuttering. I cannot do it. Nobody will believe me. When he told God, anyway, nobody would believe me that you came and spoke to me from the bush. You may think that God will get offended from him. He will say, don't you trust me? When I spoke to Abraham, he said, yes, sir. When I spoke to everybody else before you, nobody ever argued with me. Whatever I say, they say, no problem. Here I come, I send you to save my nation before it's going to be too late. And you're giving me all these arguments. That's not what God told him. When he told God nobody would listen to me anyway, God told him, you're right. What was their response? The only way they will believe in you forever is after I will speak to you in public around the mountain. Prepare everyone for the day that I'm coming down on a mountain and I'm going to speak to you in public. And then the next sentence in the Torah is, and after that they'll believe in you for eternity. And obviously he's the greatest prophet ever lived. So what do we learn from this? We see the logic of God here. When Moshe told him, no one will believe me based on my own story that you came and gave me this mission, God should have told him, don't worry. Whoever wants to believe will believe, and whoever doesn't want to believe, that's his problem. That wasn't the answer. The answer says, you're 100% right. I will make them believe in you. How? By speaking to you in front of millions of witnesses. That's the proper way to start a religion. Not by one person that comes out of nowhere and tell us stories and will right there have 50% doubt in his story forever. Did it happen or not? On top of all that, there is another argument that if you find one mistake in one of the books, such as 80,000 different religions that brought their books, geographical mistake, mathematical mistake, contradictions, parts are missing, contradictions between all kinds of versions of the book, it would leave no doubt that this is a man-made book. The problem begins is that in order for a person to write a book, to continue with the 24 books of the Tanakh, we'll need more chairs, I guess, if so. Yeah. In order for a person, as knowledgeable as he may be, could be a genius, even today, take the smartest rabbi in the world, and tell him, fake part B of the Torah. Claim that God gave us another book. Fake it, thank you. Fake it, write a book based on your understanding to claim that it's part B. In order for you to write such a book, you have to memorize, remember there was no computers at that time, you have to memorize 24 divine books. The 5 books of Moses and 19 other books that came after, the Judges, the Kings, the Prophets. It's millions of millions of millions of words. Dates, names, descendants, all kinds of information, history, stories, war, details, one after the other. Therefore, as we all know, there's no person that can memorize 24 books by heart. By starting to write a part B, you're going to have a lot of contradictions as opposed to part one. It would be much easier to come and say, this is a beginning of a new religion, not to say it's a continuation, because the continuation must fit 100% to part one. It's the same one who gave it. If you see, for instance, that in our book it says that Jacob went to Egypt with 70 people, then if you read it in any other religion that came after us that claimed that they are the continuation, then it has to be over there 70, not 75. If you see 75, then you know this book doesn't pay to waste one more minute on it. Everything else is nonsense. You don't even want to hear. Don't waste time. Why? One mistake in a book that claimed to be the word of God, it's a clear indication that for sure this is not a divine book. Everything else is beautiful. There's nice stories, magics, beautiful things. We are speaking scientific proof. Now, I want to give you an example, for instance. To prove that a book is not the word of God may take maximum 10 minutes for an intelligent person. To prove it's the word of God, it depends who you are. Usually in life, once you have two witnesses, it's enough to convict a person if they both tell the same testimony. If you see two scientific proofs in a book, that's enough for an intelligent person to realize that this cannot be a book that was written by a man. I'll give you two examples for this lady that requested that. This is a part from the Oral Torah, Masechet Brachot, page 32. Everybody knows history and knows that until the time of Galileo Galilei, everybody in the world only believed that there's maximum 6,000 to 8,000 stars. There were no telescopes yet, and people were standing on mountains and counting the stars as best as they could. In 1608 came Galileo Galilei with his telescope, which was 6 feet wide. He raised it up to the sky and he found out there's much more galaxies that we couldn't see. And at that moment, everybody in the world realized that there are much more than 6,000 or 8,000 stars. Today we know there is 10 to the power of 19 stars, and it's all approximately because with all the respect to NASA and their satellites and their mega computers and all their researches, nobody can come today with the best technology even and say the exact number of the stars. We can estimate based on the pictures that they're taking of the galaxies and what's the computer. The computer is counting, obviously a mega computer, it's like the size of a building, yeah? So the computer counting all the dots, And that's how they know how many stars approximately we have. So when we read by the scientific books, they're contradicting one another. It moves 10 to the power of 19, 10 to the power of 21, 10 to the power of 18. But everybody understands it's trillions of stars. For that, there's no doubt. Remember, up to 400 years ago exactly, the maximum number was 8,000 stars. This is a book that was written in Babylon approximately 2,000 years ago. It's concluding 1,300 years of oral Torah that was received in Mount Sinai and was passing from rabbi to son, from generation to generation. And eventually, in the end, it was written. Eventually, it was written. Once it was written by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, let's see what the Gemara had to tell us about the number of the stars. And the nation of Israel told God, "You left us and you forgot about us. We left alone, we were forgotten." The Knesset Israel, that means the 120 chief rabbis that were sitting at that time in Jerusalem, said in front of God, the Master of Universe, "A person is married a second wife. I mean, remarried. After his divorce, he decided to get married again. And he remembers his ex-wife always. And you left us and forgot about us." This conversation, it's after the destruction of the second temples, when the Jews were forced to leave the land. And you know how it is. You get a first chance, you messed up. You get a second chance. After the second chance, it doesn't look so good. First chance, you always have hopes that you're going to get a second chance. After second chance, there is something to believe. There is something to believe, a reason to believe, that maybe it's your last chance. But we have to remember that God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that thanks to their righteousness, he will never replace their descendants with any other nation. Yeah. Thank you. Again, one of the promises that God made to the Jewish nation is that as bad as they may do, all the sins, they will get severely punished as we did. But one thing, thanks to the righteousness of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he promised, he swore to them that he will give the land to their descendants and he will never replace them with any other nation. And another promise he made, that no matter how many Jews are going to die, there's always going to be some Jews that's still alive. Nobody can destroy the Jews 100%. They can do 90%, 95%. There's always going to be a group of Jews that holding the Torah in their hand. And if they won't, the prophecy say, there will be the end of this world. If you see, that's what God said, the same way, this is the word of the prophet, the same way that I am God never change, the nation of Israel will never be destroyed. So that means, if I'm going to be changed, who I am God, which is impossible because he's perfect, then the nation of Israel will be destroyed. And then in another place he says, I make this covenant with Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov for your descendants after you forever. Yaakov is Israel. And after that, the nation of Israel, after the destruction of the second temple, challenged God on his promise. They came and claimed, "You really left us. You forgot about us," because they saw such terrible time 2,000 years ago in Israel. This was the answer of God. Now, remember, the point here is the proof. We are going to show you the number of the stars that was written in the Oral Torah 2,000 years ago in Babylon. And God's answer, "My daughter," who is my daughter? Who is he talking to? Who asked the question? The Knesset Chachamim of Israel. 12 sections I created in heaven. In each section I created 30 armies. In each army I created 30 legions. In each legion I created 30 raton. In each raton I created 30 karaton. In each karaton I created 30 gistera. In each gistera I hung 365,000 ribo, it's 10,000 multiplied by 10,000 stars. And all of that I created for you. And you have the nerve to say that I left you and forgot about you? This is the Oral Torah as was written, Talmud Bavli, close to 2,000 years ago. 1,600 years before Galileo brought his telescope to the world for the first time. Now obviously you understand that 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, nobody could give such a description, I created, I hung, I did, I did, I did. When we start to calculate what the Gemara says, what the Oral Torah just told us, 12 section, 30 in each one of the sections, so it's 12 times 30 times 30, 30, 30, 30, times 365,000, ribo multiplied by 10,000, it gives us 10 to the power of 19 stars. This is in the generation that if you come to a person and tell him this is the number of the stars in the world, they put you in mental house. Why? We count only 6,000. You're telling us 10 to the power of 19 stars. Now, in the old generations, many, many hundreds of years ago, the Gentiles used to challenge the Jews about one verse in the Torah. It's interesting because they already admitted that the Torah is the word of God. But still, from time to time, they came with some challenges. One of the challenges is, when God came to Abraham and he told him, I'm going to multiply your descendants to be like the numbers of the sand on the earth and the number of the stars in heaven. Came the Gentiles and say, what's going on? That's a contradiction here. Did God bless Abraham or he curse him? Why? If he's going to bless his nation to become a huge nation like the number of the sands on the ground, then in that case, we should be billions or trillions, I don't know, a huge amount of people. But if he only blessed him like the stars, what kind of nation is going to be? 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people? Big contradiction. What was the answer of the Jews? You thinking that there is only 6,000 to 8,000 stars because that's what your eyes see. We don't go by what our eyes tell us or by what reality shows us. There are something above reality. There's many things in life that you think you understand, but you don't really. We go by what the book of God tells us. He is the creator of the world, and he told us in Mount Sinai that he created 12 sections and 30 and 30 as we have in the Oral Torah, which was passed from father to son from the time of Moshe until the time of the Gemara, the Babylonian Talmud was written down. So when the Jews told them the numbers of the stars, they used to make fun. Where they get this number? Later, when Galileo found out that there was much more than 6,000 to 8,000 stars, slowly, slowly they started to realize that the Jews were always right. It's just that it was not possible to prove it because we didn't have the technology for it. Let's see what the scientists have to tell us about the number of the stars in the world today. In 1990, Dr. T. Brewhurst from Queen Mary College in London had a research with mega computers, and he found that there is 10 to the power of 19 stars in the universe. The best part here in this proof is that when the scientists, when none of them happen to be Jewish, or maybe some of them, but there's hundreds of scientists that work for NASA and the German research of the stars, it's the Gemara gave us 7 different sanctions. 12, 30, 30, 30, 30, 365, multiplied by 10,000 stars. 7 different names. And the scientists, without knowing the Oral Torah, They named it as they found through their research with their own mother names. It's interesting. What we call Mazalot, that's by the way where the horoscope came, the 12 signs, because it's, you know how it is, the earth going around the sun, in 1 year we finish a whole circle at 360 degrees. Every 12th of the circle, it's 30 degrees. So when the earth is in this slice, this 30 degrees, it could be twins. Then it goes into the next one, it could be Aries. Then you can, you understand? So each, depend where the earth is, that's when you're born. If you're born here, that's your sign. If you're born here, that's your sign. So that's a complete circle, 365 days. So now look, what we call Mazalot, each Mazal for us is 30 degrees of the circle. They call galactic cell. What we call army, they call local groups of galaxies. What we call legion, they call galaxies. What we call raton, they call galactic areas. What we call karaton, the scientists call groups of galaxies. What we call gistera, they call groups of globular stars. What we call stars, they also call stars. All together, they admit, the scientists, that the way it's created is 7 different categories, and they have no idea about oral Torah or the Babylonian Talmud. So here is an example of information that was written in a very, very old generation when there was no telescopes, no satellites, no mega computers, not even calculators. There was no way to even know a number 10 to the power of 19 stars. And the Torah predicted something that no human being whatsoever would write in a book 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. This is one scientific proof. Let's show us one more. The renewal of the moon. The renewal of the moon, it's very, very crucial for Judaism. Why is it? Because as you know, when you get a divine book from the creator of the world, it has to be 100% precise, not 99.9. If it's only 99.9%, you basically lost everything. You know that our Torah has 304,805 letters. It's the longest book. It's longer than the New Testament, longer than the Quran. It's a very long book. 304,805 letters. If you want to bring a Sefer Torah from Israel, which is all manually written, the period of 1 to 2 years it takes, if you want to bring it from there to here, you have to carry it. You cannot send it in a suitcase or by the luggage. And when you carry it, you have to treat it with extra respect. You cannot leave it and go. It's a burden to carry it 12 hours, to bring it, everybody see it rise. It's a big mission to do it. So what do? When they don't have anybody who volunteers to bring it, since they cannot ship it by freight, they have to sometimes ship it. They have no other solution. What's the way to ship it? To leave the last letter or the last word not written. Once the book is missing one letter from a divine book, the Word of God, an unbelievable thing that everybody respect and admire. Excuse my language, it became almost a toilet paper. Why? It has no value whatsoever. You put it in a suitcase, you let the people in Kennedy throw it like they throw all the suitcases. Why? If it's divine, it's perfect. If it's not divine, excuse me again, it's a toilet paper, it's nothing. That's the difference between our Torah to all the other religions. Every other religion that manually wrote their books before printed came out 500 years ago, they were making many, many errors in the copies. It's enough that each person was making a mistake in one letter and the other one make one mistake in a different letter. Every once in a while, if someone make a mistake only in one letter, multiply it by hundreds of years like a snowball. The New Testament has more than 150,000 different texts. How? It started with one. Then it became few. Then it's like a snowball. Each one copy from the other. Each one makes mistake in one letter, which is logical, because if you have 100,000 letters to write with a feather, you're making mistake because you are a person. You're not a machine. And therefore, multiplied by thousands of years or hundreds of years, there is many, many errors. So even if you had one originally that was given from God, it's gone. You don't know which one is the original one. Same thing in Quran. Same thing in many other cults that have books. Different edition, different texts, different names, many contradictions, words are missing, letters are missing, dates are different, name of descendants, somehow in one book it shows one name and the other one it shows a different name. You have no way to prove which one was really the original word of God. We are the only religion that even though we are the oldest religion, 3,319 years ago, even though every nation in the world that throughout the generation ran after us to destroy us, nobody ever left the Jews alone. There was not one generation that the Jews have a peace of mind. There was always the Gentiles after them to destroy them, as history proved. No nation have suffered more Holocaust and pogroms like us. No nation were bothered by their religion, and nobody ever forced them not to practice their religion. They were always free to do whatever they want. The only religion that suffered depression and they ran after us, it's us. They did not allow us, the Romans, to read in the Torah, to copy it, to follow the laws. And the Greeks, and the Babylonians, and the Philistines, and the Egyptians, and many others. And we kept the Torah in the original way. No mistakes. Until this moment, even though we are the longest, we are the oldest, everybody ran after us. Every synagogue in the world that you go, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, in Hong Kong, in Israel, in Syria, in Iran, every Jew that will bring out the Torah, open it from the beginning to the end, it kept in the 100% in the original way. Is it coincidence? You have to use your common sense. Every other book, and they're not denying it, if you watch my debate with a professor, it took him a few minutes to realize what I'm talking about, but then in the end, he realized what I'm talking about, and they cannot deny it. You turn in the internet, how many versions the New Testament have? Many, many. It's a long, long, long list. Same thing Quran. Quran, the Muslims were much more careful because they knew that the book of God, you got to be very careful when you copy it. But still, they have hundreds of different versions. Still, hundreds compared to 150,000 is a big difference. But still, in hundreds of different books, the Quran in Kuwait, and the Quran right across the border in Iran or Saudi Arabia, it's not the same Quran. Is it possible to follow this one or this one or this one? Because remember, in our law, it says that once the Torah has one letter change, it's not kosher. You cannot make a bracha on it. You cannot read it in Shabbat. You all know it. If one day we see one letter moved or was erased by mistake or got smeared, it got wet, what happened to this Torah right away? They take it out, and they take a different one out. You cannot continue to read in it. Why? Because it's not divine anymore. Now, when the Torah taught us a very important law, until 1700 years ago, there was no calendar. Today, it's very easy. You have a calendar, you follow, you know all the holidays in advance. But in the old days, how did we know when is Passover? How did we know when is Rosh Hashanah? How did we know when is Yom Kippur? How did we know? There was no calendar. The Torah told us we have to go by the renewal of the moon. I'll give you an example. The Muslims, they go by the year of the moon, which is 354 days. The Christians go by the sun only, which is 365 days. The Jews go by both of them, the moon and the sun. The Christians, every 4 years, they add one day to the calendar, February 29, to adjust the differences on time. So that means if you're born on February 29 and you're now 60 years old, you only had 15 birthdays. You lost many, many gifts. But once every 4 years, you have an extra day. Jews saw that the year of the sun it's 365 days. The year of the moon is 354 days. That's 11 days difference. That means every 3 years, the holiday will move by a month. Since the Muslims ignore the problem, they don't have in their book any obligation when their holiday is going to be. It can be in the summer, it can be in the winter, there's no problem. That's why the Ramadan is moving. The fast of the Ramadan, every few years it moves, a season. Sometimes they fast in the winter, sometimes they fast in the summer. Now, Christians, since they did some kind of adjustment, because they wanted Christmas to be always in the time of the snow, and many other reasons that they have, it falls always the holidays of the Christian more or less in the same season. We were limited by one word in the Torah, since it's the word of God, and as I just finished to explain, that the word of God cannot be approximately, cannot be 99.9%, it has to be 100%. We had a problem. What was the problem? If we are going to ignore the problem, Passover will also move like the Ramadan. So, the Torah say that Passover, it's the holiday of the spring. Since the Torah name Passover, the holiday of the spring, it must be always in the spring. Now we go by a certain date. When is the date of Passover? The Torah says the 14th day of the month of Nisan. But Nisan is moving. Sometimes it's in the spring, sometimes it's in the winter. How do you avoid the problem? How you make sure the holiday will not move left or right? Let's look what the oral Torah had to teach us. That's apart from the written Torah. And God told Moshe and Aaron, this month is the beginning of all the months. We're talking about Nisan, just started a few days ago. And that's what the oral Torah have to tell us about that part of the written Torah. At that time, God told Moses the laws and the calculation of the moon and all the things applies to it. And inform him how he's going to make a leap year and calculate the months. Why? Because the Torah say keep the holiday of the spring and you make the Passover. How do we do it? Every 19 years period, we have extra 7 months in the calendar. As you know, every 2 to 3 years, we have 2 months of Adar. The year is about to finish Adar, then we have an extra holiday. Why? Whenever Passover starts falling short and it's still in a cold time, an extra extra month is pushed into the calendar, and we delay Passover by another 4 weeks, and it's always going to move in a range of the spring. It will go a little bit up and down, but it's always going to be in the time of the spring. Who told us that? We would not know to do it. God told us when He gave us the Torah, how do we make the holidays based on the renewal of the moon? 2 witnesses had to come to the court and testify that they just saw the renewal of the moon. The rabbis had the oral information that was passing from generation to generation, and they knew there is a minimum second, there's a minimum time, that the renewal of the moon can never be less than that. Never. If the witnesses come 5 minutes before the minimum date, then the rabbis know that they made a mistake. Either it was foggy or something like that, they could not see. They knew that after that second, any testimony that will be received, they will announce that this is the beginning of the month and they begin to count the days, 14 days, and that's going to be Passover. Now, let's see what the Gemara has to tell us, and this is a scientific proof. We're going to show you something really amazing, but please pay attention. At that time, the president of the nation of Israel, his name was Rabban Gamliel. He was one of the grandchildren of King David. That's 1,000 years, 900 years approximately after King David. This is from his descendants. He was the president of Israel. And he was sitting in a court waiting for the witnesses to come. And at that day, the Gemara say, 200 witnesses came. We all know that the Torah told us that it's enough to receive testimony from two witnesses, two strangers that come and say the same thing from different directions, then you know it's a real testimony. Of course, you investigate them, and if you see all the details matching, it's a good testimony. 200 came, not two, and they told him the renewal of the moon was just a few minutes ago. And this was the answer them. Impossible. And they say like this, this is how we received from generation to generation until going back all the way to the time of Moshe in Mount Sinai. Remember, there was like 1200 years after the Torah was received in Mount Sinai. The renewal of the moon can never be less than 29 days and a half and two-thirds of the hour and 73 parts of the minute. Where is it? If you want to double check me, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, page 25, on the right side of the page. That's the source. Okay, so let's calculate. 29 days, everybody know what 29 days is. And a half, what's and a half? 12 hours. Two-thirds of the hour, 40 minutes. 73 parts of a minute, you take 60 seconds divide by 73. The total number that you accept from this calculation is 29.53059. Okay? So now, in front of you, there is an original copy of NASA. And this is, as you can see here, Earth-Moon system. They calculated with their satellites and with billions of dollars. It took them more than 30 years to come up with this result. American people paid billions of dollars for that. If they only knew Oral Torah, it could save them a lot of headache. But let's see what they found. What did they find? They found 29.530588. What was the number of the Torah? 29.530590. You take a minute, divided by 100,000, the difference is 200 thousandths of a second. Cannot even count it. Take a second, share it to 100,000 pieces. Two of them, that's the difference. Two pieces from the minute. That's the difference between NASA and what the Oral Torah had to tell us that we receive in Mount Sinai. But the Germans are a little bit more precise than the American. In 1965, as you can see right here, Berlin, 1965, this is an original copy of their research. They came to 589. And that's the number of the Torah. So now it's only 100,000 of the second. Someone just told me about 10 months ago that he checked and they upgraded it to the right number, but I never saw it. That's why I cannot use it, because I didn't see it in my own eyes. I'm still looking for it. If you ever find it, please let me know. But we don't need really to find it. The question that I have to each one of you that still had a doubt about the written Torah or the oral Torah, if it's the Word of God, not the Word of God, after seeing only two proofs, after thousands that I myself have, thousands, my question to you is, there was any human being 2,000 or 3,000 years ago that was able to write that the renewal of the moon in ratio to the sun and to the earth with all the angles and all the directions and all the movements will never be less than this number, precise to 100,000 of the second in generation, that there was no watches, no calculator, no way to measure a second divided to 100,000 pieces. Everybody understand it, right? Even today, you need very, very special computer. Even this advanced computer will not be able to calculate such a thing. So, do you see any person that could write such a book? And this is the oral Torah. You know, some people, they say, okay, we believe in the written Torah. We believe. But the oral Torah, we have a lot of questions. Maybe the rabbis made it up. Maybe the rabbi added information to it. So the answer is, this is just two. There are many, many other examples that leaves no doubt that the book could never be written by a human being, only the creator of the sun, the creator of the moon, the creator of all the galaxies was able to give us such information. From the book of Carl Sagan, it's the head manager of NASA, and this is in his letter he wrote 29, as I showed you, 530 588, and this is basically just one other example. You want another proof, or we should go to the questions and answers? Questions? Questions? Who wants more proofs? Raise his hand. Don't hesitate. Just who wants? No? All right. I'll do another 2 minutes proof. It's a short one, and we'll move on. Here. By looking at the sun, do you see the sun is covered with a pill, with a bag, with a cover? By looking at the sun today, what do you see? A round yellow ball. You don't see really any cover, right? You look at an orange, right? You cut an orange by a half, you see the orange has a peel, right? By looking at the sun looks very similar to an orange. But by looking at it, do you see that the sun has a peel? You don't see it. King David, in Songs of Songs, actually in Tehillim, he wrote like this. It's Tehillim 19:5. The sun has a cover. The sun has a cover. This is 3,000 years ago. The Midrash that was written 1,800 years ago and conclude information that we had 1,500 years passing from rabbi to students. The Midrash wrote, the sun has a cover. This is Bereshit Rabbah, chapter 6. The Gemara says, in the future, there will be a time that God will take the sun out of the bag, just before the big judgment days, as we all know, but that's not the topic right now. The point that I was trying to make is that we have two sources here. One in Tehillim, 3,000 years ago, and one in the Midrash, 1,800 years ago. It says that the sun has a cover. Obviously, nobody could see that the sun has a cover. To write such a thing and to be right means you had to receive this information from the creator of the sun. Because by looking at the sun, there's no way to see that it's covered with some kind of peel, right? Let's see what the scientist has to say. Doctor, today with the technology that we have, we can do a lot of things that we cannot do 2,000 years ago. Dr. Vidal, a famous astronomer from the British Union called Greenwich, he wrote a book, it's called The Army of Heaven, and this is what he writes. Those layers observe the radiation and the heat that comes from the center of the sun. Those layers, external layers, we call the cover, Antarctic, the bag, the cover. The area A, which is right here, that's the center of the sun, just that you know. Right here, in the center of the sun, the heat arrives to 15 million degrees Celsius. Is more than 20 million degrees Fahrenheit, like in America, more than 20 million degrees. This is the center of the sun. If you travel from the center of the sun towards the end, before, this is really the cover, just before, when you reach the internal part of the peel, you're going to see that it went down to from 15 million to 2 million degrees. 7.5 times less. Just when you travel to the external side of the cover, the temperature right here, it's 6,000 degrees Celsius. So 15 million, 2 million, 6,000. If this is this dot, it's the Earth. By the time it gets from 6,000 and it travels all the way to Earth, it goes down to 40 degrees, as we all know, that to provide us with the right temperature that we need to live. This is the only stars, by the way, that there is normal temperature for the life of creatures and species that are existing here. Any other star around us, the scientists measure the temperature, it's hundreds of degrees below zero or hundreds of degrees above zero, which means once you get there and you come out of your spaceship, you either burn in a second or you freeze in a second. The only place that people have the normal temperature to live is right here. But that's what he writes. Area A, it's the inside of the sun. If those radiations will arrive to Earth, it's so strong it will burn the entire world. So now, obviously you see that the distance between here to here, it's much, much longer than from here to here. But from here to here, it went down only 7.5 times. And from here to here, it went down 35 times. 35 times lower. What are we see? That it's not just a regular peel. It's layers that absorb the entire heat to prevent this heat to burn the people over here. But that's, no, I don't care so much about what the scientists write. That's not the important part here. The important part that I'm trying to highlight is what book was able to write 3,000 or 200 or 2,000 years ago that the sun is covered with a peel. Just imagine that the scientists would find today that it's a normal ball of gas without a peel. But since it's so far, it's very far, the temperature by the time, you know, like when you have a fire 6 feet away from you, the closer you get to the fire, it's hot. The further you go, it's not so hot. It doesn't need, the fire doesn't need really a cover. So it's a you gamble by writing in a book that it has a cover, and today they would be able to prove that there's no cover, would be a big problem, would be the first mistake in the Torah. So obviously all these things, as you can see, are showing us that a person, a human being, as sophisticated as he may be, a genius as he may be, take all of them together, give them all the equipment you want, would not be able to write such things. But that's only three. That lecture alone has more than 100 proofs. It could take, I once did that lecture from 8 o'clock in the evening, right across the street, a few blocks away from here, Ocean Parkway, that was a few years ago, from 8 in the evening until 7:30 in the morning straight. Nobody left. 12 hours. There were not enough chairs, so there was people were sitting on the floors. Nobody left until when I came out, I saw bumper to bumper on Osher Parkway heading towards Manhattan. And thank God it was such a good lecture that almost all the people over there became fully religious. Why? Once you show 100 proofs, okay, if you're skeptic, you saw 2, 3, you're still not 100%. But after you see 100, what excuse you going to make, right? All right, now let's go into the questions and answer. It could be from any topic, any subject. Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, it's a hot topic right now. What the Torah has to say about life on other planets?
I will answer you, but I rather answer questions that are productive for our own life and test here. We want to achieve something in this lecture, to talk about things that are so irrelevant to our life. It's a waste of time, but since you ask, I'll answer you anyway. 750 years ago, the students of the Ramban, which was a huge Kabbalist, they wrote, based on what they received from the rabbi, that there are no other species like us with a free choice in any other planets, any other star. Today, we have a contradiction what they really meant. Did they mean that there are no people at all? Not nothing? Or they meant that there are, but they don't have a free choice like we have to be righteous or wicked? You understand? Because you understand that the only difference between us and all the other living creatures is that we are the only one that lived with a free choice to do good or bad. Everybody else lived by an instinct, right? An animal, it's programmed. He's hungry, he's attacking. There's no way to convince him, please, stay hungry for 2 more days. Have mercy on the goat here, you know? You understand? So obviously. So the point here that we are the only one that are subject to punishments. Why? When you have a free choice to do good or bad, and you chose to do the bad, society prepared for you a jail or all kinds of penalties. Why? Because they knew that if you wanted, you could have held yourself from not committing that crime. Nobody ever put a tiger in a trial. Why? Just an hour ago he attacked a zebra, right? What's the point of punishing him? He doesn't have a free choice. You may put him behind bar because you're afraid the next thing is going to eat you, but you don't trial him. Why you don't trial him? Because, you know, there's nothing to find him guilty. He's really not guilty. Okay, so we don't know 100%, but we know for sure that even if one day they'll find other species over there, they're not going to be like us with a free choice.
What does the Torah say about what happens to your soul when you leave the body? I mean, I know it's a big subject, but I find that really fascinating.
If you enter my website, I have 3 hours lecture about it, from A to Z. All the steps that the soul travels through until, from the time he died, until the end of the steps that the soul has to go through. The lecture also includes information about reincarnations. All my lectures is based on science and Torah. You know, it's a combination. Because I found that the most productive way to prove people that that's a divine book. And once people see it's a divine book, when they read next to it, you have to observe the Sabbath because it's a covenant between me and you. Or when you read as a Jew that God say, I chose you to be my nation, you are my children, I love you more than all the other nations, it makes him proud that God chose me to be his son, you understand? But when he doesn't believe in the Torah, what's the benefit of reading in the Torah that God chose me to be his son if I don't believe in him? All right, so the point is to prove. Now, I'm going to briefly answer you. You know, it's a long subject, but briefly I'm going to answer you. The first thing that happened to a person after he had a crash or after he got shot, seconds after, the soul exits the body. The body falls down, and the soul flies right above the body and hear and see everything that happens around the body. So, for instance, if they take the soul into the hospital and they have an operation, the soul is right above the doctors, that they see exactly what they do in the heart, with the electric shots, with the brain, whatever they do over there, he sees. The soul, it's not a material. Some of the people who died and were able to come back to life, we call it clinical death, some of them said that they were trying to pick up the phone and dial 911. But they have no way to grab anything. Only material can pick up material, you understand? An energy, a spiritual soul, cannot interfere with material. So therefore, they were trying to scream, they didn't want to die, obviously, but there's nothing they can do, but they can hear everything. What's the proof? According to science, if a person is dead more than 6 minutes, which means he has no brain waves, no oxygen goes to the brain, no pulse, no breath, few minutes after, he doesn't get any feelings when you pinch him or burn him. There's no response. 6 minutes is considered death according to science. 6 minutes. That's the rule, but there's always an exception to the rule, you know. So the doctors do not know how to explain how there are millions of cases in today's generation, more than ever before, that people died and came back to life after 6 minutes. Now, according to science, if a person died and he came back to life after 6 minutes, it won't help him that much. Why? Because his brain should be severely damaged. However, we find more and more cases of people who died. I have a few movies about it, that people came back to life way after 6 minutes. They describe everything that happened around the body in all these 10, 20 minutes that they were dead. They describe what happened in each room of the hospitals, in all the floors, who died, who got saved, what doctor just left the hospital, what's the roof of the hospital, what's on the roof. Many, many interesting things that they report, even though they were dead in the first floor in the hospital. So obviously it cannot be a dream. Also, in the beginning, the doctor, the cardiologist, all these parapsychologists in the beginning, they were trying to say that probably there are chemicals in the brain, and they're giving him all kinds of illusions. And when he wake up, he sees like a movie, but it's really not real. But obviously, it's nonsense. Why? Because he's not just saying a story. If he got up and say, I saw my friend from high school and I saw my grandmother, fine. But when he gives you information that can be proven a minute later, what the chemical has to do with that, that he was telling you that somebody just died in room 712 and his name is such and such. Where the chemical can give him such information. So obviously it's nonsense. People in this generation easily believe scientists. But the truth is that if you pay attention to what they say, you will see that almost everything they say, it's nonsense. Everything. And the point for that is, I just give you an example. The age of the world, right? If you ask a scientist from Harvard, from Yale, from the best universities in the world, how old is the world? They're all going to tell you millions, billions, trillions of years, right? What did the Torah say? 5,768. 5,768. Don't get me wrong. There are a few scientists that admit that the world is only a few thousand years old. 10,000, some close to that number. So they're very close to the age of the Torah. But the best part is there are two ways to prove that those scientists are lying to us or they lie to themselves. They just believe, but they don't have any information. There are two kinds of science. There is objective science and speculative science. Science that based on speculations and assumption, it's not an indication to anything. What's the proof that they're all wrong? Very simple. Nobody has the beginning point. When they calculate, for instance, carbon 14, their formula can be correct only in certain scenarios. In different temperatures, it's not working anymore. Plus, they do not know the creator of the world when he created that object, how much carbon 14 it had in the first day. Not each object had the same one, so therefore there's no way to calculate. But they take advantage on the public's ignorance. Then another way they use is extrapolation. It's an assumption since this thing grew in 1 year, 1,000 times bigger. That means we're going reverse and calculated. We measure him. That means every year he grew by the same way, which is nonsense. We are the best proof for it. We grow from 0 to 18. We grow a lot. From 18 to 100, we don't grow by an inch. So it's all nonsense. But we don't want to go into that. I have a very smart way to prove that all the scientists are lying about the age of the world. What's the proof? I'll give you the proof. Let's say now we have 50 people here, and we all have to know how old are you. I don't know you. Nobody here knows you. So he says 20. He says 21, 22, 23, 24. Each one of us gave a different age to you. Is it possible that we all right? Is it possible that each one of us were right about your age? He say 20, he say 28. Is it possible that they both right? Okay. In the best scenario, maybe one of us is right. And maybe not even that. Please explain me how in the last 20 years we heard hundreds or perhaps thousands of different results from the same scientists that went to the same universities and had the same professors and use the same tools to calculate the age of the world, and each one of them came with a completely different result. The scientists from here say 300 million years, and the one across the street say 300 trillion years, or one say 10 million years. Everybody come up with a different age. Why, as an intelligent person, I should waste a minute with their nonsense, or a penny from my money to buy their nonsense when in the next year he himself will come and say, everything I told you until today was all not correct. This is the new invention that I just came up with. If you don't believe me, check Stephen Hawking, right? Some say he's the best scientist in the world, right? Until a few years ago, he sold us his theory. He sold millions of books. And what happened 5 years ago, approximately, one day I turned the radio, 1010 News, and new information from the great scientist Stephen Hawking. What? The world, we believe now that the world was created from a pea, a green pea. I was listening to this, I thought, maybe it's a joke. No, that's the new theory. I don't know what he means by that. I didn't go into it. I just give you an example how a respectable scientist that were selling us a theory for 20 years, one day come, put his theory in the garbage, and start all over and selling us something new now. What do you see? Don't waste a penny with them. Don't waste a minute with them. Because they're all, I don't want to say lying, but for sure they're mistaken. Okay? That's for sure. All right, now going back to the soul. There's a point that the soul start to elevate and go up towards heaven. Some people reported that they came to an area and they started to see that there's no really walls. It was all with no limits. And they saw relatives that come and welcome them as they walk there. They all reported that they go through the tunnel, and in the beginning it's very dark, and then they see a huge light. Some reported that the light communicate with them through telepathy. Some reported that they show them all their lives. Remember, they were dead only for a few minutes, but they saw 30, 40 years of pictures, one after the other, when they were since they were a baby until now. One non-Jew reported that they showed him his life, and he was very, very embarrassed about the things he did. And he was full of frustration. I wish I can go back to the beginning point and reconstruct my whole life completely different than the way it was. And his conclusion was that I realized for the first time that all my life was a waste. I did not achieve anything. I did not complete anything. I did not learn anything. This is his conclusion. If you want to know a little bit more about it, you go into Raymond Moody. He's one of the greatest parapsychologists in the world. He has websites in the internet, and he wrote many books about it. It was translated to 30 different languages. And Dr. Elizabeth Kovler-Ross, she's also a world expert in that. And Dr. Ian Stevenson is a world expert in that. I have a list of about 30 top parapsychologists that investigated that between 5 to 20 years, day after day, night after night. They interviewed thousands of people, and they found out that each one of them comes up with the same stories. And obviously, it's impossible to think that all these people set and planned to cheat the entire world. You know, obviously, it's from different cultures, different languages. Okay, now, one of the things over there is that some people, when they see their relative, one person reported that a girl came to him and said, "Nice to meet you, I'm your sister." It was a little kid that died. He was about 5 years old. When he came back to life, his parents were sitting in a hospital, and he told his parents, "I just saw a girl, her name is such and such, and she just told me I'm your sister. How is it possible? I never had a sister." And they started to cry, the parents. "We never wanted to tell you before you were, just before you were born, she died." So just before he was born, he never even knew that he had a sister. She was a little girl. She died, and all of a sudden, she came and said, "I'm your sister. You understand? Nice to meet you." You see, so this is interesting. If you watch my lecture, the best part in the lecture is that everything I just told you was written 100% in the Torah. You can see in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, in the Zohar, the Torah already told us everything the parapsychologists found in this generation in details. The soul, how the soul comes out of the body. One of the rabbis told is the other rabbi in the yeshiva. He told him, "When I die, make sure you bring all the students and make me a great eulogy, because I'm going to be right above you, watching and listening to everything you're going to say." This is a Gemara in the Talmud. And many other examples. That's not the time now. Any more questions?
I have to disprove the Torah. I was in the bed one time and somebody told me that in South America and Brazil they also have mass revelations where like thousands, tens of thousands of people claim to see
UFOs?
Not UFOs, but like at the same time, like we claim, like we receive the Torah. They claim that they see something.
Makara. No, Lama, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, they claim to see something.
What's the point you're trying to make?
Where did with the divine people. I don't know how to answer that because he said that, and that's going to be my proof that every other religion was started by one person. No one is. How could I do these thousands of people who claim to see the exact same master religion?
All right, first of all, one have nothing to do with the other. One has nothing to do one with the other. The fact that people came and claimed that they saw lights or UFOs or anything like it. Shh. What's going on here? Shh. The fact that people came and saw and claimed that they saw a light or something that looks like a plate with lights flying in space has nothing to do with religion. One thing has nothing to do with the other. It's a question, are there UFOs that come from a different stars to visit here or to do something here? The answer is, until this moment, we have no indication that even one person was able to bring one proof that there is a visitor from out of space. A proof means, here is the plate, here are the aliens, we are seeing them right now, we're able to touch them, to take picture, to try to speak to them, that's a proof. Saying that we saw a light, it could be a million things. I'll give you an example. Okay, I'm going to have to stop the lecture, I'm sorry. But that's going to be my last answer. So, the proof would be to bring something, an evidence. So far, it's only stories. Now, how do we know if it's an evidence or stories? It's very simple. In the Air Force, especially in the Israeli and the Americans, which have a very advanced Air Force, they have all kinds of little planes. It's called spying planes, without a pilot. It's by remote control. They can send it from Israel to Iran. It takes pictures of all the places. They see it on a screen, and they see where the plane is flying, and they direct him to a place. And they go, and it's like an helicopter. It can come to a place, and it's taking pictures, and they bring it back. Now, just assume that one night you sit in the roof of your apartment, and you look up, and you see something with light in a weird shape is flying. How do you know what it is? Maybe the Americans sending something to Texas to make an experiment or something. That's not an indication of a UFO, obviously, right? So we did not find any solid evidence. And you know what? If they find... It would be a great excitement to know there are other aliens somewhere. What's the big deal? What is the contradiction against God? God did not write in the Torah, there is no other aliens, or don't ever expect a visit from out of space. So therefore, it's not irrelevant.
What do you say about evolution? How can you prove wrong evolution?
Okay, first of all, you know, evolution was never proven. It's a theory. The theory of Darwin... The theory, it's one out of millions of theories to the creation of men. Millions of theory. For whatever reason, that theory was more successful than all the others. In America, in some states, they pass a law that a professor that will say that the theory of Darwin, it's a fact, all right, it's against the law. Some states are still permitted. But if they want to teach the theory of Darwin, they have to write based on a theory only. Why? Because in America, they are very religious. And most of the American citizens believe in God. They have all kinds of surveys. 70% of Americans believe in life after life. More than 70% of Americans believe in God. Not all of them follow the laws of God, but a lot of them believe in God. It bothers many religious Americans that they teach people that we came up from the monkeys, knowing it's a lie. Now, I want to tell you something. First, you should know that the followers of Darwin completely, but I mean completely, modified the theory of Darwin from A to Z. The theory of Darwin has nothing to do with what they teach today. If you check the original theory of Darwin, after a few years, they got stuck, and they took it from the beginning to the end, and change it completely. So therefore, you see right away, this is what happened with all the theories. Once they get stuck, somebody come and renovate it and made it into something else. But still, before that, what are they claiming? That there was a monkey, and slowly, after hundreds of years, or thousands of years, or millions of years, whatever they say, One day he became an intelligent person, and the tail disappeared, and now he's standing straight, no problem. Please explain who created the monkey. A monkey is a very sophisticated machine. Muscles, ligaments, brain, eyes, just the eye of a monkey. You know what a sophisticated system is this? Who created the monkey? Monkey had to have a creator. Who created the world? It's not really, it's not an indication or proof against the fact that there is a creator to the world, right? So it's really an irrelevant theory. Why? It's true, the Torah say, I created man in the 6 days of the creation. So all they are contradicting really that God created us directly. They just claim that he created monkeys, or not him, somebody created the monkeys, and we are one advanced species of the monkeys. They have to explain how come there are still monkeys out there, why they did not become advanced and only some became advanced. They have to prove, to bring a proof to what they claim, because they so far never provided with one proof. It's all based on theories. It's all stories. Why should I waste my time on assumption and theories? Why?
You know, there was a joke. There was only one person who believed that he came from monkey. It was Darwin's son.
Darwin is not so happy when he sees the theory that they teach today. There's nothing to do with his. Yeah.
What about this person to follow everything Torah says? What about this person? I say, now he knows the Torah is true.
Yeah.
What makes him magically obligated to follow what it says now?
Read the Torah and you get the answer. Read. I'll give you a discount. Don't read the whole Torah. Just read the fifth book. What do you call it? Deuteronomy? I can never say this word. Deuteronomy? What's the name of it? Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy? I can never learn that word. Huh? You got the point? Sefer Dvarim. Learn that, and you see what's the request from a Jew. You should know one thing. You should know. The Torah writes very clearly, I'm testing you to see what's in your heart. Are you going to follow my laws or not? Or all the tortures that you have for me is to test you. Would you follow and keep the laws or not? What's the rest? To benefit you in your end. You understand? So there are many, many places that the Torah writes that every second of our life is a test. And obviously, until the Torah was given, the test was very limited. All the nations in the world, include the Hebrews, include us, were only obligated to keep the seven laws. Only obligated to keep the seven laws. After the Jews received the Torah in Mount Sinai, we jumped from 7 to 613. Most of them are only in the time of the temple. We don't have the temple today. So most of the 613, all the sacrifices, all the 10% from the wheat, the barley, all these laws, the high priest in Beit HaMikdash, is only in the time of a temple. So today it's a much easier way to live according to it. Plus, not all the laws apply to everyone equally. Some laws are to women only, some laws only to men, some laws only to someone that has a business and have employees, to pay them on time, not to cheat them. Someone is not a boss. Right there's about 7-8 laws that does not apply to him. Some laws are only to a butcher that's slaughtering animals. Me and you don't have nothing to do with it. Some of the laws apply only to farmers. So it's really not that many today. So the point is like this. After the flood, when there were only 8 people left in the world, Noah and his wife, his 3 sons and their 3 wives, God restarted the world 4,200 years ago. There was the flood. From this moment, after Noah came up from the ark, there was nothing yet, Jews, no Jews. There was only 8 people in the world. And one of them is Sem. Sem was the righteous son of Noah. Someone who hates Jews, they call him anti-Semite. Why? Because we came from the descendants of Sem. Understand why they call it anti-Semite? We are the children of Sem, as the Torah writes that he was the righteous son of Noah. Abraham came from Sem. His other son, his name was Yefet. In English, it's Jeff. Yefet means beauty. 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 Those people, based on the information that we have, went to the areas of Europe. All the Europeans, some of them, the Europeans and the Americans, they all came from this person named Jeff, Yefet. Then we have Ham. Ham was the third son of Noah, that as the Torah described, that his descendants were in Africa, the black people, most of the black people in the area of Africa, some of the Arab countries that are close to Africa, they are the descendants of this person called Ham. Now once, after a few generations after Sem, there was Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Jacob, God came to him and said, your name is not Jacob anymore, you became Israel today. That's the first time you hear the word Israel in history. That was 3,400 years ago approximately. Then after he went Jacob to Egypt because there was starvation, there was nothing to eat. He went to Egypt, his son Joseph was the treasury of Egypt. From that moment, they lived in the city, in the place of Goshen in Egypt. Later, the Jews started to assimilate it with the Gentiles in Egypt, and the punishment were not late. Right away, the Egyptians saw that the Jews are all over. It bothered them very much, as it bothered almost every other nation in history. Whenever the Jews were successful, right away, it bothered them very much. And what happened right away? The punishment was right away. Either a Holocaust or pogrom. In this case, it was slavery. 210 years of slavery. After then you know the story, Moshe come to Egypt, he take the Jews out. 49 days after the Exodus of Egypt, we received the Torah in front of millions of people. Once we received the Torah, we became a special nation. But one mistake a lot of Jews are making. A Jew is a special chosen person only in certain conditions. A Jew is only holy, as the Torah say, you are holy to me because I'm holy. You are my children, I chose you from all the nation to be mine in certain condition. You cannot take it for granted. What does the Torah say? If you keep my laws, if you follow my ways, if you listen to everything you do and you make me your God, your Father, then in return, I will make you Am Sgula. Am Sgula means a special nation with special abilities. And then come all the restrictions, not to marry the non-Jews, and not to look like them, not to dress like them, to be different than all of them. It's not in our choice. This is the orders that we receive. It will be much easier for us to do whatever we want, to eat whatever we want, to marry whoever we want. Much easier life. But those are the restrictions that God gave us. But if a Jew does not keep, for instance, the Sabbath, or he ignores the Torah and the laws, the law says that he excludes himself from Judaism, which means if a non-Jew that keeps the seven laws of Noah, after the flood, all the world received the seven laws before Judaism started. If a non-Jew anywhere in the world, regardless from what culture he is, if he keeps the seven laws that God obligated him to keep, he is a righteous Gentile, which has a part of the world to come in a limited way, because the test is very easy, it's only seven laws, but he's a righteous goy, righteous non-Jew. If a Jew does not keep the laws, some of the laws he ignores purposely, then he's a wicked Jew. Some of the laws does not exclude him from Judaism. For instance, if he's a thief, he's a violator of the law. He's violating the law, okay, but it doesn't stop to become a Jew. If he eats not kosher, he violates the law, but he's still a Jew. If he does not pray, he violates the law, but he's still a Jew. But if he does not observe the Sabbath, or he bow down to idols, or he believes that God has a partner, or a son, or there are two gods, or any other authority, like the Greeks used to say, the God of love, this and that, or like the Christians say that God has a son, even though it's against the Ten Commandments, this Jew has no part of the world to come. Every Gentile that believes there's more than one authority from God violates the Ten Commandments. And at that moment, he loses all his rights. He loses eternity, he loses his world to come right there. Therefore, the Muslims, believe it or not, even though they could be murderers, certain Muslims, not all of them, but those who are murdered, if they stop murdering and they make repentance and they regret what they did, they are keeping the seven laws. One of the seven laws is not to murder. But if the Muslim murder, he has a violation, therefore he's not a righteous Gentile. But for those Muslims who have nothing to do with the killing, They believe in one God. They never dare to say that God has a son or any other authority. Therefore, if they do not murder, they obey the laws of the court and the police in their place. They do not eat any raw animal before they kill them in the right way. They do not bow down to any idol, don't make any statues over all of that. They love God and respect Him. And they do not steal. How many I say? Six or seven?
Six.
Oh, and sex crimes in a family. The sex crime, it's called Gilui Arayot, is different between a Jew and a non-Jew. That's the difference. A Jew has very, very strict laws when it comes to sex and relation. For instance, a Jew cannot meet a girl in a club or in a bar and go and live with her like a husband and wife. Why? He has to marry her first. The non-Jews don't have to really get married. They can love one another and they move in together and it's not a violation for them. They can go in the night that they met and live together like a husband and wife, no problem. But as long as they're together, they're also not allowed to cheat. They decided to be like husband and wife. The Goyim copy from us the tradition of getting married, because it's come from the Torah, to marry or to give divorce. But they really don't need it. This is something that they copy from us. All they have to do is get together, and they move in, and they're not wicked. They did what God ordered them, they have no problem. But if they, God forbid, if they sleep with their mother or with their sister or the seven relatives or they become homosexual, one of those things, they violate the seven laws of Noah. All right, that's the seven laws. But if they sleep together as they just met, they have no sin, no violation. Plus, they don't have the law of purity or impurity. If they live together like a husband and wife, if the woman has her period, she doesn't have to go into the mikveh, she doesn't have purity and impurity. They don't have restriction on relation. They can do whatever they want, they have no problem. But we cannot go single guy and single woman. It's a big sin. A husband that have relation with his wife in her period or after the period before she went down into natural water, mikveh or spring water, it's a very, very serious violation. Okay, they don't have to eat kosher. They can eat whatever they want. They don't have to fast. They don't have to eat matzah. They can eat whatever they want in Passover. All these laws. But a Jew that drink beer or eat wheat or barley on the 7 days of Passover, it's a very serious violation. You understand? So now, to conclude, my answer to you is that once God gave us the Torah, He elevated us to a very high, a much higher test and much more difficult test. But according to the test, that's how the reward or the punishment. So if we fail, it's very difficult. I have a lot of non-Jews that comes to me, especially after the debate, that wants to convert, and I find myself spending hours every week convince them that it doesn't pay for them. Remember, we are not missionaries. It's against our religion. We do not go and beg people and try to prove them to convince them to join us. The opposite. If they come, the Torah says, send them, tell them to come 2 years later. We have no interest whatsoever to run after other people and make them come to our religion. But if they did, and they're not giving up, we have to convince them that it's better for them to stay Gentiles. Why? All we have to do is to teach them the seven laws. I have one guy from Manhattan that I taught him on the phone the seven laws. He wrote it down. He's a righteous Gentile now. He keeps the laws and that's it. And that is a righteous Gentile. There's some website on the internet, the seven laws of Noah, that they teach them. I think Chabad puts it up. For every non-Jew that wants to learn what God ordered the Goyim after the flood, they keep it. They're 100% clean. Those who later made all kinds of religions and they want to follow the laws of their religion, either they waste their time or they violate the rules of God, depending what they do. For instance, a Muslim don't eat pork. Where did he learn that? Islam is only 1400 years old. How did the Muslims had an idea not to touch the pig? They saw in the Torah. God told the Jews, don't touch that animal. So now they don't eat pork. Does it count for them as a law, as a mitzvah? No. They're wasting their time. They can eat as much as they want pork. They're not obligated. But you should not steal, everybody in the world is obligated not to steal. Everyone. You should not kill everybody. To believe there's only one God and no other, God forbid, or that God comes into a body and becomes the person, become divine, all these things that people made up, it's a very serious violation against the Ten Commandments. So therefore, sometimes people want to be righteous. They want to be righteous in front of God, but because they are not educated and they just ate everything that their friends and people fed them all the years, therefore they missed everything. They missed their opportunity. So I always say, the worst danger to a person is ignorance. The worst. In everything, not only in religion. If you work with computers and you don't learn good what you have to do, you're going to work sometimes 10 times more. Why? Because you don't know that by pressing 5-6 buttons, you can send 5,000 emails in a minute. If you don't know, you're going to sit a week, one email after the other. Why? You did not read the instructions. Okay? Any more questions? Yeah.
Why is it wrong to eat meat and meal together, mix?
The Torah repeated it 3 different times. One is not to eat them together. One, not to cook them together. And one, if you by mistake cook them together, not to sell it to anyone. You have to destroy it and not receive any money for it. Why is it?
Scientifically, why is it wrong?
Yeah, okay.
Mix life and death.
Excuse me?
You don't want to mix life and death.
No, I tell you something. There are mystic reasons for that. Meat is judgment, milk, it's mercy, there's all kinds of reasons. But my experience and my understanding is to answer every question that people ask me, why God made that law, why God made that mitzvah, why God made that commandment, the answer is because this is what God wanted. If you would know all the secrets and all the reason why God made us all these laws, you would become God. You would be in His level. You understand? We do not understand even 1% of the secrets and the reasons why God do things. Why He created us to begin with. We know, generally speaking, we know that He created us a place for a test. And in order for us, once we pass the test, He's going to reward us. Since we have a free choice, there are punishments involved also. You do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. Why God needed that? Nobody will be able ever to know what's God's reasons. Now you have to know. Some people say, why you have the laws to respect your father and mother? Why? Because they raised you. You have to be grateful. What? Your father worked 20 years to pay for your education, to feed you. He cried with you, he laughed with you, he walked you, he did so many things for you. Well, you're going to betray him now. So it's very logical law. You got to respect your parents. It's all nonsense. That's not the reason why God say it. Why? Because God said that you have to respect every human being. Even a non-Jew, you have to respect. You cannot steal from him. You cannot cheat him. There's laws in the Torah. It's not only your brother, you cannot steal from him. You cannot be a thief. You cannot kill. It applies to everybody. You have to respect every person, to be nice to him. You know, I mean, whatever means nice, you know. So if I have to be nice to somebody that came from Japan or China that I have nothing to do with him, don't I have to be at least as nice to my father? Right? So why does God tell me to respect my father and mother? Even the dogs respect their parents. Everybody respect their parents. The Italians in Italy that don't have the Torah, they respect their parents or no? Sure they do. They do. So what's the reason? Because in the Torah of God, there is a law to respect your father and mother. He made you a father and mother. The Torah was written before the material world was created. The oral Torah taught us a secret. Based on the Torah of God, that's how He made the world. The Torah, it's the blue.